This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
Rabble.ca.
FM. I'm your host. Oh, there we are. I think just in case my volume was low, let me try that again. Welcome. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Darren Kaster, and we're, of course, broadcasting on CIUT as well, our wonderful and very appreciated community radio partners internationally, as well as the rabble.ca. A great website that is also hosting our show, and of course the our own site, which hosts our show with the extended podcast version, which is great. Woo. Sabina's here. She's going to be talking about a bonus show when she figures out what she decides it wants to be later. but for now, a couple of quick announcements, and then we're going to go straight to Stefan, because there was, you know, as usual, there was a lot of news to talk about. I have 17 tabs open, and that was just my sort of choice picks. But there was one sort of that sort of overshadows them all, which was the quote-unquote Panama Papers scandal. So we're going to go to Stefan for that in just a minute. A couple of quick reminders slash announcements in the meantime. First of all, next week is the CIUT Spring 2016 membership drive. I didn't say fall this time. Which is next week. That'll be next week's show, so please do stay tuned for that. We'll still have a couple of good guests, including Angela Bischoff from the OCAA, as well as Tim Nash will also be joining us next week. And then the following week after that, if my math is right, is it right?
Yes, it is right.
Yeah, 2 weeks from this, from 2 weeks from this very day, Earth Day, in case you're confused about when that is because maybe you're not listening live. If you're in the Toronto area, also please join us for our 500th episode celebration. We did, in fact, go to all the trouble of you know, slightly adjusting time and space such that our 500th episode landed on Earth Day.
I still don't know how that actually worked.
You're welcome, Steph.
Yeah.
So I spared no expense.
Yes, over the over the 9.5 years to randomly land on Earth Day. It's just, I want to go back and actually see how that happened.
Yeah, I bet it was all a cunning plan by Jordan Popek. But before we get on too much of a diatribe before, without going to the news, let's go straight to the news. So, Stefan, please start us off. Panama Papers scandal.
Okay, so this may already have been beaten to death in your minds and brains, but it's only going to keep going for quite some time. So I'll start off by giving a quick rundown of some of the facts of this thing in case you haven't heard them, and then we'll get into a bit of why I guess we think it's important for the environment and why we think it's important to this sort of environmental justice lens, because as I sat up this morning trying to I was going through all the data and I was reading it off, and I've been reading articles like every day about this for the past week. And you keep hitting the same sort of all the articles of Panama Papers take a similar track, right? It's about one person in it. They're usually high profile, and then it runs through all the data, the same information that you've seen before, and then says, "And there's more to come." Mm-hmm. And the reason why there's more to come is because this was a unprecedentedly large leak. This was a leak in sizes of information that didn't exist 10 years ago. I remember like a couple years ago when I first heard of the word terabyte, and I was like, what's that? And it's like, oh, it's like 1,000 gigabytes. I'm like, that's already so much. So what the Panama Papers are is a leak of 11.5 million documents. From a Panamanian law firm called Mossack Fonseca. I probably should have figured out exactly how to say that.
Sounds very reputable. Carry
on. Yes, exactly. One thing to know about here as well is that this is just Mossack Fonseca, just one of a bunch of other firms that do the exact same stuff in different tax havens. This is not the end all and be all of avoiding tax. This is just one firm within this larger subset. And the leak itself is 2.6 terabytes of data. So that's 2,600 gigabytes of data, which is about all of the songs in the world. I don't actually know if that's true, but I feel like it could be.
It's all of Napster put together.
Ooh, you dated yourself. Yeah, that's from way back. So there's a couple of interesting little side stories to this. Which is first that it's actually it's a massive undertaking of collaborative journalism, because over 100 different publications, all led by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, have all been working on this. In part because it affects everyone. This has touched on leaders from China to Russia to there's 200 American passports in this leak. There's Canadians in this leak. There's the United Kingdom's Prime Minister David Cameron is mentioned in this leak. It's everywhere, and so all of the different journals they gave it to different people. So in Canada, it's the CBC and the Star have access to this, and they're part of this consortium. And it goes all, but that's how wide ranging this is. So it's a worldwide issue. And what this really is that these 11.5 million documents are leaked, and they cover offshore accounts and tax havens in places like the British Virgin Islands and Panama and all things like that. This particular firm actually sort of focused a little more on the UK, which is actually like why you see this being a slightly bigger deal in Europe and in that than the United States. Because United States offshore accounts are such a normal practice that it wouldn't like that it's not making much of a not nearly the splash it is there.
Nobody's surprised.
Yeah, exactly. Well, because it's just This was interesting. I was going to get to this later, but I'll jump in now with it, which is that one of the most interesting takes on this, on the entire thing, is from Glenn Greenwald, which it often is, in which that what's real, the real scandal here isn't that people are doing it, it's that it's all legal. It's the same sort of thing in with the WikiLeaks, some other WikiLeaks scandals, which is that what's really concerning here, it is concerning that it's happening, but everyone sort of knew it was happening. What's concerning is that it's also legal. And so there's almost no one in this, there's no actual, the worst that's going to happen are people resigning. Which gets me to the bit of the follow-up, or the fallout of some of these different things, which is that there have been massive protests in Iceland. And this is going to kill me. The Prime Minister Sigmundur Gunnlaugsson.
I think he did a decent job.
Yeah, all right, I'll take it. He stepped down, although he only said he stepped down temporarily, which I don't think counts as stepping down.
Just long enough for it to blow over.
Yeah, I don't think that counts as stepping down. I think you stepped in. Like, if you leave, you leave. But he had $4 million in Icelandic bank accounts, or Icelandic bonds, bank bonds, through an offshore account, which he sold to his wife for $1 before becoming prime minister. But this caused massive protests in Iceland. If anywhere the pandemic papers have caused unrest, it is in Iceland. Largely because when he did this, Iceland was still in the throes of the banking crisis, and so to avoid tax at a time when Iceland was basically going under, because it didn't
have that's why he hit it.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, so he has stepped down. David Cameron is on, as I said earlier, is under some fire, but that one seems like it's probably going to blow over. Perhaps the biggest irony of these so far that's been discovered is that the Chilean head branch of the global corruption watchdog Transparency International had to resign because he had 5 offshore accounts. That one's like not obviously a big name, but it's just ridiculous. Some other places.
What's in a name, Steve?
Yeah, exactly. Putin was sort of their lead story. He had $2 billion in different ways he sort of spent money at other places.
But I was watching some Russian television. Apparently, that's just he's coming up for an election.
This is just to
smear Putin, actually.
Right, of course. So also, he still has elections. Why do they even? Anyways.
But all the Western leaders totally did it. But
right,
they're lying about him.
Right, exactly. So the more kind of terrifying, the more direct. I'll get to the sort of the larger concept of this sort of tax evasion and that sort of offshore account thing in a second. I just want to mention two quick things. One is that it's important to note that being connected to these papers does not imply any wrongdoing. But what's also interesting about that is that that's written in every single one of these papers, which I think was like intentional as a way to just. And to be fair, like a bunch of the American passports turned out to be just old people buying houses like to retire. Mm-hmm. So that actually is they're buying. They want to live in the Cayman Islands. Let them go to the Cayman Islands. But I think it's interesting that that's the level of protection that the media has sort of gone to
I think that's because essentially this is a giant list of wealthy people,
right?
And they're protecting themselves from liability. Like I think that's really all that is. Yeah. I think it's just like, okay, well, here's a bunch of really powerful people. Let's not make sure we have to be absolutely crystal clear that we cannot be seen to be implying that anyone has broken the law, because to assert or to imply that that's the case without having any proof, they could get in a lot of trouble for that, right? So they're just covering their butts.
Yeah. And so the other flip side of the dangers of offshore accounts is that it also ends up being a big supplier of sort of the dark money that goes into sort of the conflict zones, the places that we're trying to sort of like the money that's sort of supporting the regimes that are actually doing despotic things and that to get around sanctions.
Terrorism?
Yeah, terrorism for sure. There's a whole link to it which I won't get into, which the brother-in-law, I think it is, or maybe just something like that, the Syrian leader had a bunch of accounts in this firm was running for them, and then of course HSBC, because HSBC cannot be a big league without HSBC being coming under fire at least for one thing, so their Swiss bank or their Swiss branch of HSBC just put all of this guy's companies in good standing, despite the fact that they were based like this was 3 years after the Syrian war began, but anyways. So this is what I want to get to. So that's basically this is a massive, massive leak of all of this sort of tax evasion, basically. And tax evasion is a funny thing, in part because it sounds really boring. No one wakes up in the morning, or at least very few wake up in the morning, and be like, you know what, I really want to read a thriller about tax evasion. This is going to be great. You know, James Bond was never sent after people evading taxes.
Maybe he should have been.
Maybe he should
but
have
he
been.
But he was not.
Exactly.
Because Q was one of the people that was evading taxes.
Right. Yeah. Well, and M definitely had some offshore accounts.
Guaranteed.
Yeah. Well, you know, MI6 was not the most transparent. Let's just move on from that sidebar. What I want to get to here on is that a couple weeks ago, we touched on who society protects in power. And if anything, this conversation is about power. This conversation is about who and what power gives you and what power does not, what power can take away, or lack of power can take away. Because what's so fascinating about this is that not only is it completely legal, it's also encouraged to some extent. So much of this sort of avoiding taxes is standard practice within these governments, and that it's. That we don't even that you would almost be judged not to. You're seeing like these opportunities that you'd be stupid not to take. And so it's this thing where we've created a society, and to go back to really put a finer point on it, we see all these movements which I described 2 weeks ago as movements were basically around people telling society that society doesn't protect us. The Black Lives Matter movement is saying, literally, Black Lives Matter, which is saying that society does not treat Black lives like they matter. So maybe society should we want a society that actually acts that protects us. And then this is the exact opposite of that. This is the other side of the spectrum, where you can have these case in point examples of people basically saying, "Hey, government, I'm not going to pay you a ton of money, and I'm going to intentionally use these loopholes which you built into your system, so I cannot pay you money, and you're going to let it go."
Right.
And there's another throwback to a different story, but very similarly, the CBC story, which was that that Canada Revenue Agency gave a bunch of high KPMG people working with KPMG basically a carte blanche to come back and pay your back taxes. They caught a whole bunch of people avoiding taxes, and they were like, just pay your back taxes and we won't actually fine you and come after you. And it's these kind of protections that when you see this in the two ends of the spectrum. So like if one week it's the people whose society doesn't protect saying, hey, protect us, and 1 week the people the society that protects just walking around. I can't help but have this sort of I just want to put those two sides. To me, that's what drives the sort of my confusion with the insidious nature of complacency. Like, because being complacent in our current society is a privilege only afforded to a few, and it's afforded to the people who either are in power enough that they are being given all these extra things. But there's a whole bunch of people of us who are sort of in this middle range. I won't call us the middle class because then Kevin Farmer will wonder, will make a joke about how the middle class is literally everybody now. But like, there's people who aren't, you know, who society does protect physically. In like a, you know, in a physical nature, like my body is protected, but we aren't afforded the sort of these veils of power and the sort of that the rich and famous get. And I think if you want to look, when you look at environmental justice and you look at trying to bring people under, trying to protect everyone who needs protected, and you can't separate Flint, Michigan, where there wasn't enough money to get lead out of the who was poisoning kids' water mains from the same people, from the people who are just, you know, who probably live in the same state, who are taking money away from that state by hiding it somewhere else in a legal loophole.
Well, and let's remember why. They didn't have any money. They didn't have any money because Governor Walker gave millions of dollars in tax breaks to the companies that were doing this. So he took the money from the population, gave it to these companies, and these companies went and shuffled it off in some tax haven. So not only did they not have the money by voluntarily reducing revenue for the state, but it then doesn't even get taxed and goes and gets filed off in some hut somewhere and registered under a house that has 8,000 other largely fictitious businesses in it. I mean, this is so systemic to the point that that's why everyone's like, you know, it's something we all know, right? Like that's what I think it was Cenk Uygur from the Young Turks who put it this way, and I really liked it this way, was like the shocking thing here is not that this happened. The shocking thing is that we already knew this was the case, and that's why nobody's surprised. Like, that's why, like, this should be the biggest thing ever. And the fact that it's not, the fact that it's legal should be the biggest thing ever. These should be riot-inducing things. And I'm not suggesting I want people to do this, but I'm just saying, like, as far as the level of corruption that this case, by my definition, I don't care if someone else wants to call it legal. You change the laws to suit yourself. It's not just. It is antithetical to justice. The fact that nobody is surprised is the thing that should be the news story.
Right, exactly. And I think that sort of brings me to the sort of final point that I'm trying to wrap up with, which is that it's nobody's surprised, A, that there are all these people who aren't being protected, and nobody's surprised that there's all these people who are being super protected, and that the way that these are coming together is that we've just accepted that this is how society works. And it's just... It's to me what brings me to sort of the sort of level of like, okay, we know it's broken, let's fix it, and let's fix it from its core, because that's really the actual, because you can't solve this problem with trimming here and there. Mm-hmm. As much as Trudeau's hair might think that a slight trim can make it look beautiful, it still won't actually solve the underlying problem. If I could leave us with one thought, it is that the Panama Papers aren't so much about, you know, Lionel Messi finding a way to save himself a couple $100 million. It's about Flint, Michigan, and the places in this world that we're sort of letting people die, quite literally letting people die because for lack of funds. In the same jurisdictions where we're letting a bunch of people walk away and buy a third yacht. These are the same story, and we have to think of them as the same story, and they should be reported as the same story.
Yeah. So thanks. Thank you for that review, Stefan. I have two quick comments as well, and then we'll go to Edward for our free music break here. I think there's two really important, and we'll just touch on them quickly because, you know, I couldn't have asked for a better timing for this story, seeing as I want to do my three-part series on the limits of democracy and the limits of capitalism coming up in a couple of weeks as well. But just to touch on it as a bit of a preview for now, one of them essentially is that, you know, people will say, all these things that society wants, right? So whenever, you know, Elizabeth May now has been talking about an issue that I think is very, very sane, and we'll be discussing it when we get to those episodes, which was the guaranteed minimum wage. Well, we can't afford that. You'll have to raise taxes. Yeah. On like 12 people to pay for that stuff. All of this money exists. Most of the things that would generally benefit society as a whole. I'm not saying, you know, gold-plated golf carts for everyone, We're saying basic necessities for society to have a functioning society that would, and again, we'll get into the longer argument for this in when we get to that show, but, you know, things like, well, what are the two biggest causes of crime? Well, poverty and drug use, and one of those influences the other one too, right? And so, like, a lot of these societal problems comes down to basically two things: people not having enough, and so either not dealing with that well, so, you know, maybe using illicit drugs and therefore being a burden on society by creating disruption and anarchy and whatever, blah, 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 and health problem, and, you know, feeding up, blah. And the other one is mental illness, right? And there are some people that are just criminally insane, right? Or just, you know, we just need to be locked up for the safety of society. It has nothing to do with their socioeconomic status. Well, we can help both of those things. The only reason we aren't is because we theoretically supposedly can't pay for it. Well, guess what? All of those hundreds of trillions of dollars that are hiding in offshore accounts, that's our money, which comes to point two, right? So think about all the time, like, we're going to get to a story after the break that will really highlight this, but think about all the times when there's, you know, all these things the public has to pay for and bailing out the banks and all this stuff. All of those people they're fine. The year after the financial crash, all of those bankers that caused the crash, that did the gambling that caused the crash, that you didn't benefit from, they made record-setting bonuses. They made the most money they've ever made the same year that everybody else pretty much lost almost everything. Canada was shielded a bit better than US. Yes, that has nothing to do with the overall point. So again, we're going to come back to this both after the break and ongoing. But there is a massive direct link between this type of behavior and the environment. It's not a stretch in any means, because, you know, one of the things people, I want to keep my money. I don't want to pay taxes. Why should I be taxed at a higher rate? Well, you know, if you own, and here's the really thing which people don't think about, and I think you can use it as an example and think about it for a minute about how many other examples like this you could come up with, is that it was like, well, I shouldn't pay such high taxes, but, you know, because I do this and that, and why should I pay more? Well, okay. Well, if you're, say, Walmart, and you have 100 million trucks on the road that each weigh a couple of tons, you are responsible for a gigantic portion of the damage to roads that the public then pays to repair. That's why you're paying taxes. You are costing things that we as a society have put together forward for general use. You're benefiting from their use and increasing the cost of maintaining them. And that's what you have to pay for. This isn't some fine on being successful. This is actually paying for what you take. And the fact that there's a different set of rules, like the example I want to make is the thin blue line, right? Everyone understands that idea of, you know, cops protecting each other. There's a different set of rules. You know, we can get it. We won't get into it on this program right now, but, you know, Black Lives Matter, obviously there's a direct, you know, thing there about cops protecting each other. Well, I'll tell you, there's another group of people that also have different rules that apply for them, and it's super rich people. And they don't go to jail. They don't pay taxes. And all of that stuff they do get comes out of your pocket. And comes out of you, and you pay the price for their wealth. So let's leave it there for now, but we're going to go to Edward for a music break. All right, and we are back. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm sitting in studio with Stefan Hostetter as well. Sabina is also in the studio as well. Sabina Hasseni, did I get it right? Oh, yeah. Sweet. So Samina's going to be joining us a little bit, after the show, or a little bit later in the show if you're listening to the podcast version, and we'll be jumping in probably at the end of this segment to let us know what she wants to talk about, and possibly jump again if she disagrees with something I say, which is what I told her to do. She's our quality control expert here as well. So the story I wanted to get to now is that Blankenship gets a year in prison over mine safety conspiracy. Blankenship is the CEO of a West Virginia coal company, and this is a record setting. It's a very interesting story. It's a record set because this is actually the first, according to the Bloomberg story. I wasn't able to do research beyond the story on that. I couldn't confirm it, but I'll just assume that Bloomberg in this case is correct. The first American CEO to ever actually be sentenced to actual jail time. So essentially what happened was he is the he looks like someone who fancies himself a lord in the very old setting, and apparently he carried himself as such. Donald Blankenship presided over his coal fields from a mountaintop castle that also included his employees that lived in the area also. I don't know. It wasn't clear if they were instructed to, or if this was just sort of a little bit of Stockholm syndrome, but flew the company flag over their homes.
was interesting. Anyhow, so he has been sentenced to, I believe, 1 year in actual prison. They're saying most likely because he's rich, of course, he'll go and, well, they say because of the shortness of the because of the shortness of the amount of time that that he actually is going to do it in low security prison.
Yeah,
as
probably.
Well. And the idea is that they're saying, well, it's only a short amount of time, so we don't think he needs to go to maximum security prison. I'm sure a whole bunch of low-level drug offenders that are spending a year or less in prison would love to be
in
the lowest security prison. But that's an aside. But what's really interesting here, there's essentially two things here that I find very, very interesting. First of all, how is this possibly the first CEO ever to go to jail?
It's gonna go to jail as for something you've done within the company, right? It can't be just no CEO has ever been convicted of any crime.
The Bloomberg story is not clear, but I would actually say that that's very likely based on the story from before.
There has got to be at least one CEO who just murdered somebody and went to jail. There just has to be.
All right, so let's put an asterisk on that.
Okay.
But the other interesting thing here, which is interesting, so he didn't speak at his own trial, but there was a whole bunch of recorded phone calls that heard him saying things like, never mind the safety regulations, you have one job, which is to get coal out of the ground. There was a number of people that had made complaints about him. The trial was a disaster that killed quite a number of people who worked at the mines, and they then later 29 miners in West Virginia. They had tons of recordings of him just being like, "Never mind that. Never mind the security. We'll just get more stuff on the ground." So this is definitely a bad person. this is certainly a bad person. He was specifically and explicitly, not just implicitly, not just well, the blah blah blah. No. He was like, "Never mind the safety regulations. Your job is to dig coal." So this person, in my opinion, undeniably deserves to be in jail. However, there's another interesting wrinkle to the story, which is that the part of the defense claim here from his lawyers is that the person who is going to be the U.S. attorney involved in the case is now running for governor and has made this the center of their campaign. So they're making a, I think, entirely legitimate argument that this is also political. But I think both is the case, and so part of the reason I chose to talk about the story. One of them is that, it's important. It's somebody who's was instructing his employees to not follow regulations and deserves to be in jail. But the other thing was that the back and forth there I think is very relevant to what we were just talking about, which is that. There's the conversation that happens in public, and then there's the actual conversation. And I think it's almost certainly true, and this is just my opinion now, just to be careful, but I think it's undeniably true that this person did things that they shouldn't have that led to people's death and that should be criminal, whether or not he's ultimately found, whether or not they get him out on an appeal or something like that. But also, it is totally political, and it seems pretty undeniable that this person is using this case to get elected. And so just within the context of having the American election on right now and all these other things, and because Bernie Sanders having a larger conversation, we're going to get to Brad Wall in a minute. Just all this, or sort of all this talk of all this political extremism, and I include both extremism that I approve of and extremism that I don't, that I do of, being Bernie Sanders, of course, and that I don't, being Donald Trump. But just like within the context of the story and within the context of the American election that's going on right now, just how much there's sort of like what it is that we're actually doing and the conversations that we're having seem to have no connection whatsoever to actual reality. Mm-hmm. And that's where I'm hoping that you'll jump in and give me your thoughts on that, Stefan. It's just the idea that there's sort of like, well, these big scandals, like even during our most recent with Trudeau, right? Mm-hmm. There are all these things, well, these things, whatever, and blah, blah, blah. But really, at the end of the day, like how much of the conversation was really about the effectiveness of policy and making arguments for and against, and how much of it was talking about people's hair and, stirring up racial tensions and that sort of thing.
Like. Right. I think there's this idea that was actually given to me, or it was, it was floated out to me last year about the idea of a pre-meeting, which was at a work thing, and we were getting this idea of how most of the work in a meeting is actually happens with the conversations you have before you walk into it, rather than the conversations you're having once you get there. And I think that sort of that fact that that speaks to this idea that there's always this sort of reality floating around what actually ends up getting portrayed and getting absorbed. Because we as society only have 24 hours in a day. You know, theoretically, we are most of that time we're actually spent, you know, living our lives doing other things, and then maybe we read this one story about this gentleman, like for about 5-10 minutes. And so we take from this story. What's fascinating about this is like when you mention both sides, that's what this sort of the amount of intention we're allowed to give falls down, which is that if you want to hear the story as political opportunist attacks totally functioning normal businessman CEO, you can take that from this story. If you want to take the tract of horrible CEO kills a bunch of people and gets away with only 1 year, while heroic prosecutor ensures gets some time,
uses this as an example to chain never make sure this never happens again.
Exactly, you can take that from it as well. And I think it's this fact that where we can look at any like so many stories, like stories have layers, and there are very very few stories that are like this is the thing that happened. This is why. Let's talk about it. In the same way that sort of that the you know flashback to the Panama Papers. In the same way that reporters have to be careful not to include just retiree wants to go to the Cayman Islands with you know David Cameron having $4 million having being given money through offshore accounts from his dad. You have to parse all of these things out. And we just don't have the time to do that in a day. And so much of this complexity come, and then that's the difficulty of these sort of stories, right? Is how do you match those two things? And then to flashback to a conversation around before the radio show, where Sabina walks in and is like, "You've probably talked about every single thing over and over and over again. You must be like let's talk about climate change again," which is literally we should just call every store every day every month like we should have let's talk about climate change again. The Green Majority, just have that as our name for a show every week. The explanation for what we end up doing is because she's right. Every week we mention the word climate change, probably. I'd be interested if you go back in time and if anyone actually wants to listen to all our shows and let us know the percentage of shows we mention the word climate change. I would be mostly impressed, given that, again, we have our 500th show in 2 weeks.
Are you daring people to go back and listen to 500 episodes?
I am, yes. The point that I get here is that when you have all these sort of different people, like, when someone asks, like, what are we really doing? When you report the Panama Papers, we're not reporting a bunch of facts, but what we're also doing is sort of trying to give you a wider context for these facts. Because without the wider context, you're just throwing darts at a board. And then people can see the darts and be like, either you're a great shot or you're a terrible shot, but you're not actually, you know, but that's their subjective opinion. And their opinion is entirely based around their understanding of darts. You know, like it's like if you think darts is you're supposed to miss the board, then yes, nailing it.
Mission accomplished.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what you're doing unless you give this wider context. If you don't give this wider context and this wider narrative that these stories fit into, you're just giving people a bunch of fact points which they can then take into whatever they feel like and then use them back out into the society and spread just as much truth as not truth.
Yeah,
you know, fact and stat points are only valuable when they come within a understandable narrative, and stories like this highlight that so much.
Yeah, so let's actually take that moment to get the switch over to Brad Wall here for a second, in the sense that Clark, who's been on the show once now, and we're hoping to get him back soon. I actually asked him to come in today, and he wasn't available, unfortunately. But just to talk about this, because you know, I think they're really the only thing we can say here, aside from the fact that Brad Wall is, has some pretty terrifying opinions about climate change and the direction that he thinks the Canadian economy should be taking. All of the articles about this are talking about, well, you know, he did so well as a politician that, is this the last remnant, but also the potentially the site of the rebirth of, you know, conservatism in Canada? Because, look, he did really well. But the actual story here that actually matters is is this person's ideas right? And not, there are certain parts of somebody's ideas, of course, that are subjective, but are certain things that are objective and are provable. And he's just demonstrably wrong about a bunch of really, really important stuff. Right. So Clark will come back in at some point, because we're going to talk more about Brad Wall, I'm sure, in the future. And he'll come back and help provide some of his very interesting. Actually, we had an after show conversation about this, and he provided some very interesting insight as to why Brad Wall is so popular in Saskatchewan. But that the fact remains that why are you equating the number of votes somebody got to anything other than how good a politician they are? But that there's an assumption, oh, well, they're a good politician, therefore, like, being a good politician means you're good at getting people to vote for you. It doesn't mean you're an effective administrator. It doesn't mean that your ideas are correct. It doesn't mean that you're informed about any of the issues that you're talking about. It just means that you were successful at convincing people to vote for you. And that is it. Right. So when we have these conversations, I don't care how many votes he got. What it matters is what are his policy ideas and what is the numbers and facts that actually back that up? And what actually turns out, aside from the fact that he's very, very popular and he was very successful at getting people to vote for him, is he right? And the answer is no. In most cases, not on everything, of course, but on most of the things that I think are objectively the most important because they have the most long term impacts and implications for Canada, he's dead wrong. On a lot of them. And that's sort of, this is that idea of those sort of two conversations about everyone's talking about, whoa, he got a lot of votes. So, I guess he's very important. Maybe he should be running for Conservative leadership. Yeah, but he's wrong on everything. Not everything. Right. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, but I think what's interesting is that it really comes to one sort of conversation that often happens, comes out of election reporting, which is you have a couple options for election reporting, right? And there's stock version ways to talk about election reporting, and one is what does this mandate mean he gets to do? That's the most popular one usually is like he now has a mandate to do these things, and I still remember when Harper won with 30-something% of vote, and then the conversation was like Harper's mandate. I'm like, he won 30% of vote. It's not a mandate. Wall obviously won over 60, and so that's he arguably does have a mandate to push his agenda.
One of the
forward.
Most overused words that is almost never used in a way that makes any sense whatsoever is mandate.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. it presumes that all of the voters who vote for the person know exactly and want exactly the things that the person has then said. So that's one option. The other way to report it is that sort of what we're seeing with Brad Wall, which is that sort of, is this the new face of Conservative leadership? And is this what, and it's really more of a, it's sort of a piece about whether or not we'll be writing more pieces about this in the future than actually what's happening on the ground. It's a more higher level thinking piece, which doesn't necessarily actually impact, like, what does this mean for Saskatchewan? What does this mean for people in Saskatchewan? How is this going to impact your daily life? It's more just like, in 2 years, will we still be talking about Brad Wall? Or will he not be important anymore? And you see the new conservative ads about are now all championing the new Ontario PC leader and then Brad Wall is like the face of conservatism, which remains just white dudes. You'd think if they're trying to any sort of sense of understanding how to actually pitch anything, they'd do that. I think that this is like falls into one of those reporting and what I'm into, like, we'll see. Like, yeah, Brad Wall has been basically a massive climate laggard within, and that's what obviously we're referring to when you say he's wrong, is that that's the one thing he's sort of obviously fighting with honestly almost the rest of the provinces at this point. He's like, you know, we suddenly have an Alberta government that might be willing to play ball, and yet now we have their neighbors being like, but do we?
So let's take another pause there as well. Brenna Owens is going to be joining us for the last section of the show, but we're going to go to a music break first. But before we even do that, Sabina is going to jump in and surprise me. What is the bonus show going to be about today?
Climate change. And that's actually the truth. So today on the bonus show, we're going to be talking about Catherine McKenna's statement at the Progress Summit, where she said that many Canadians would turn against action on climate change if the government went too far too fast. And I see Brenna shaking her head there.
Well, I was at the Progress Summit.
Oh,
so
perfect.
I have to hear that in person.
Yeah.
Fabulous. So more from both of you on that topic.
Exactly.
After the show, after the main show as well, yet another great reason to listen to the bonus show. I just want to take a quick second as well. We received a ton of really interesting email recently, a lot of it about last week's episode, but also I think a lot of people obviously heard my appeal for
let's do more of this. You send us your idea, whatever. We got a whole ton of emails. So I just want to, I'm still going through it. I'm a little bit behind. I apologize. But just for all the listeners who did write in, I did see your email. And thank you so much for doing that. I will be responding to you soon. And for any other listeners, please do send us your thoughts, send us your comments, send us your show suggestions. Tell us when you think we got something wrong, because that happens probably a lot. But without anything further, Edward, what is our second and final music break going to be? All right, so we're back. We're into the final session here, the home stretch of the Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM, one of our wonderful and very appreciated international community radio partners. You could be listening on the podcast for the extended version, which we'll be talking about some more politics here as well on today's bonus show. Or you could be listening on Rabble.ca, one of our other very appreciated syndicate partners. Quick reminder again as well, next week will be our spring membership drive. We're also going to do an extended bonus show to that we also produce a show, hopefully, maybe even a full-length additional show, so that there's an actual show in addition to the fundraiser. It will just be done off air, so don't worry if you're for two reasons. One, because we actually have some cool guests coming in for the fundraising show, and as well, we'll also be producing an additional show as there as well. But start saving your pennies. Maybe get the small coffee instead of the large today. A couple of bucks here, a couple of bucks there, and help us raise some money for CIUT next week. It will be very appreciated and very needed. This is important revenue. This is actually how the station functions and how we're able to be bringing this to you for about to be 500 episodes is because of CIUT. So please stay tuned for that. Put some loonies and toonies and maybe a couple of 20s aside, and we'll see you next week for that. And secondly, of course, for our 500th episode party, which is the week after that, you can we'll be giving away some tickets for that, Stefan, during the fall fundraiser, or I keep saying fall, spring fundraiser next
fall
week.
Fall into spring.
Fall into spring next week, and you can also just get some. It's greenmajority.ca. It would be very nice to see you. It's nothing super pompy. We're just going to have a beverage and hang out for like 3 hours after the show that evening. It's going to be fun. Please check it out, greenmajority.ca, for all that and more. Without further ado, though, the final section here, we're going to talk a little bit about sort of solar energy, renewable energy, and water. I'm going to try and tie it into one. One of them was, I'm just going to skim through a couple of headlines, and I'm going to open it up to you guys to see, you know, how you want to string these together. One of them was that the Netherlands has now said, they've just, in a majority vote, has now said the Dutch Parliament that they are committing to no longer allowing new sales of petrol or diesel cars. That's right. Full electric only, it appears, after 2025. So only zero emission, sustainable zero emission cars will be purchasable. This, of course, will not prevent used vehicles from being purchased. So this does not eliminate all petrol or diesel cars off the road. It will simply mean that no new ones may be sold. And this also combines with some emission standards too. So it's not just going to result in a whole bunch of like super polluty old cars being driven instead of newer ones, because there are also certain regulations to you know, the emission standards are still in effect. There's some skepticism, of course, from opposing parties. Nobody's surprised about whether or not this is doable. But this is interesting because this was part of a deal, eight U.S. states and five countries, one of which was the Netherlands, joined the International Zero Emission Vehicle Alliance, pledging to make all new passenger vehicles electric for sale, fully electric by 2050. This is the Netherlands going above and beyond and saying, we're going to double down and do 2025. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty cool. So let me do two more really quickly, and then we'll open it up for comment. Another one is something that crossed my digital desk, if you will, is a drinking tower that pulls water out of thin air. Now, there's I've seen a number of these types of things. Of course, Bill Gates Foundation has been very investing in trying to provide water and scarce resource support, if you will, for developing nations. There was the Reinvent the Toilet Challenge. There was a fancy system that converts toilet water to drinking water. Also some other people like Matt Damon, who's the co-founder of water.org, who have invested lots and lots of money specifically in Africa in a lot of the cases, to try and do this. However, it's maintained one ongoing challenge, and that one ongoing challenge is that technology is expensive and requires upkeep and repair. And so even if they can pay to have all this fancy technology installed in, you know, relatively speaking, compared to, you know, what we're used to here in Toronto, fairly simple villages with very very lower access to sort of resources, shall we say, that, you know, they require a lot of money to keep them upkeep, so the ongoing costs would be very, very high. There's nobody around who has the equipment, the expertise, or the education to actually repair or maintain them. So generally speaking, a lot of these initiatives have been massive wastes of time. They've come up with some really fancy technology, which isn't cost-effective in rich countries and isn't cost-effective in developing countries. And basically, they're like, good for you. You made a really expensive widget. Mm-hmm. So what's really interesting is that this is supposed to cost $500 currently. It pulls water directly out of the air, so you don't need to drill hundreds of meters or thousands of meters underground. Thousands of feet, hundreds of meters underground, and literally pulls it from the air. It uses passive solar technology to power it and is otherwise all based on the material. So these can be easily assembled from fairly inexpensive things. For reference, the toilet that the Bill Gates Foundation came up with is about $2,200 for the initial buy and install, plus ongoing cost to repair it, even if you have somebody handing around who has an advanced engineering degree. These cost about $500, and that's at their current production level. They think they can get the cost down to about half that or less. So about $250, anybody can set it up, very easily knowledgeable, and will provide clean drinking water directly from the air. Very interesting. Last story, and then we'll open it up for comment. Solar industry says that 70,000 jobs are knocking on Alberta's door. There's some very interesting back and forth numbers in the article. This, of course, is, people should assume, because they've been doing an amazing job recently. This is from the National Observer. And there's some interesting back and forth here about, maybe doing it this way is a little bit better, or doing it that way is a little bit better. If you're interested in solar opportunities in Alberta, I'm going to just suggest that you read the article, which, of course, like everything else, will be linked in the show post. But the really interesting thing here that I wanted to sort of point out was that what was it a week ago, and we'll get into Catherine McKenna in a few moments, and I know Brenna's sort of very eager to talk about that, and maybe she'll help us segue into the bonus show with a comment about that angle on it and some of Justin Trudeau's recent comments about the oil industry. But there was somebody who was like, this pipeline is going to create 132 temporary jobs, and then 22 of them will be permanent, 70,000 jobs building solar panels just in Alberta. Suck it, oil. That's my summary. Stefan, right. For comment.
So I want to just jump back to the first one, which is the EV sales, in part because it's also, the larger conversation, of course, has to include Elon Musk and Tesla's latest. I think it's Model 3, which has sold over 200,000 pre-orders already, and the conversation around electric vehicles has sort of been ramping up in right around now, largely because of Tesla sales. And so in response to that, you're seeing some very interesting backlash, specifically from perhaps climate change's most infuriating gentleman, Bjorn Lomborg, who just has made a career off just being wrong about things, but getting to call himself an environmentalist while basically advocating for fossil fuels, who makes his
living traveling the world and providing facty sounding arguments for climate deniers to use in why they should vote against climate policy. Just be clear about what his job is.
Oh yeah, yeah. And his tweet really fits that perfectly, which is his tweet was, "All electric cars sold so far will postpone global warming by 30 minutes by 2100. The price tag, $9 billion in subsidies."
Lomborg is famously bad at math.
This was then retweeted with some snark. Some agreeing with Lomborg, some snark by a couple different Canadian journalists. And so it got to my attention. I did some math. And it's 9 billion euro. It's not American dollars, it's euro, because it's a British study or a European study, which is 9 billion euro is 0.2% of yearly fossil fuel subsidies worldwide. So this is 0.2% of what we're currently giving fossil fuels still, as they are the richest companies in the world worldwide. And yet you're pitching 9 billion as if it's an ungodly large number, while it so much pales in comparison to the, I think it's 3.4 trillion euro that still to this day goes to the richest companies in the world for fossil fuel exploitation. So to pretend that this is somehow an expensive price tag, especially when the fossil fuel subsidies, when everyone defends them, it's like, well, we need the fossil fuel subsidies to support their energy sector. And so what is different? What is different between this and if you need it to support the energy sector, which is the most profitable sector, how on earth can you then say that it's you, so you're wasting your time with electric vehicles? You're just intentionally committing this failure.
But yeah, and these are the same people that people connected to the oil industry in Canada will come out with a completely straight face and say, you know, well, renewables aren't ready because they're going to need a whole bunch of government subsidy. Mm-hmm. Unlike us, because we just put it in our pocket, you chumps. I'm assuming that's the other half of the sentence. Right. I'm just, you know, paraphrasing.
Yeah. And the last the little bit on that one tweet, because it really bothered me, you can go on my Twitter if you can find it. And then also tweet me a picture of a turtle, because I'm still on this campaign.
you did get one tweet of a turtle.
I got one tweet of a turtle, but it was from someone I knew. It didn't count. So the other piece of this is that what I love about this tweet from Bjorn Lomborg is that it sort of implies that it lacks an understanding of bell curve of curves in that it's and that's all electric vehicles sold so far. So basically, it's like, you know, if you look at a sort of normalization curve, which I'm sure Sabina can correct me on what they're called in the bonus show. I guess I'll describe them to you and you'll explain it to me. But if you understand the sort of curve, what he's basically saying is like, we're just at the beginning of a massive expansion of electric vehicles. But that doesn't mean we're changing at all. Obviously, it's still useless. Why should we care? And it's the exact same thing as if you look at... it's like someone in the early 1900s being like, well, if you took all of the cars that exist now, you'd only save 30 minutes off your drive. So why would we ever switch from horses? Yeah, it completely misunderstands the fact that we're the beginning stages of this change, and you're completely just not understanding that.
Yeah, I'll take my earlier comment back. Bjorn Lomborg is actually very good at math. What he does with math is he constructs it in a way so that there people who aren't good at math think that the opposite of what's true can be concluded. Brenna now is going to join us just for the final minute of the show to help us provide a segue to the bonus show where we're going to talk a whole bunch about how this relates to Canadian policy. So please do. Yeah. We got about 4 minutes. Please jump in.
Just a couple remarks. So talking a little bit about electric vehicles. So obviously it matters where we get the electricity to fuel those vehicles. So the CBC just a few hours ago today released an analysis by Don Pittis of the business unit in which he says that the CAPP, Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers, has announced a $50 billion drop in expected new investment in the oil and gas industry. So this is also relevant to the new solar jobs in Alberta that we were talking about. And this comes from an academic journal, Applied Energy. And kind of the innovation, he says, of this report is that it extends the concepts of stranded assets. So for instance, fossil fuels that have not been extracted into the ground yet to the actual equipment and infrastructure of the plants. Mm. And it really provides like a business case for why continued investment in fossil fuels is actually going to be like bad for our economy, like from a purely almost investor point of view, and which is not really the view that I'm used to articulating or arguing from. But this is incompatible with what we've seen the direction of the new Canadian government going. Like I had, you know, Prime Minister Trudeau's remarks at the Globe Summit a few months ago about how pipelines and renewables are not incompatible. And also then Environment and Climate Change Minister McKenna at the Progress Summit, where I was just last weekend, making remarks that if we take action on climate change that's too fast, it will disrupt national unity. First of all, national unity sounds suspiciously like something John A. Macdonald would say. and I actually heard someone quote John A. Macdonald in making a case against proportional representation, and I think that was a low point of the summit. So, I'm looking forward to the bonus show and kind of digging into this concept of national unity and how it's being used to drive a wedge kind of in what it means to be Canadian and taking action on climate change.
Yeah, and I think it's sort of we have like 30 seconds left in the main show. So just to sort of wrap up the show, and we'll be back with Sabina, excuse me, and more comments from Brenna on this topic as well, is just that, you know, this is the idea of, you know, the establishment sort of protecting itself, because all of a sudden Catherine McKenna, who has quite a bit of... educational experience on climate change suddenly apparently is forgetting some of the hard facts and numbers that she was trained in because they're completely incompatible with her current statements. We'll have to leave it there for the live show. Thanks for listening to The Green Majority this week on CIUT. If you want some more, go to the website and get the podcast. We'll be right back for that. Other than that, see you next week for the spring fundraiser. Have a good week. Green week, folks.